Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll discuss the indigenous people in northeast Florida when French Fort Caroline was established in 1564.
So on a day-to-day basis, most Mocamas lived in a community run largely by women. So households were run by women, who in turn made up the town, who was governed by either a male or female chief, or Olata.
We'll discuss an historic hurricane that prevented an invasion of Spanish East Florida.
Prior to the hurricane on October 4, 1811, Juan José de Estrada, the interim Spanish governor of East Florida, had begun preparations for the expected invasion and anticipated multiple defections to the American side.
And we'll talk about civil rights activist and union organizer Marshall Jones, a professor at the University of Florida in the 1960s. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Fort Caroline was established in 1564 as a French Huguenot settlement on the St. John's River near Jacksonville. When the French arrived in Florida to create a European settlement, indigenous people had been living here for 10,000 years. Denise Bosset is professor of history at the University of North Florida.
Part of the reason the French select this area is because of the Mocamas. And the Mocama are a nation of Tumuqua speakers, whose ancestors and predecessors had made this region into their homelands for thousands of years before the French arrived. They were a highly complex, interconnected nation, themselves comprised of towns, probably 10 to 20 towns, under the leadership of paramount chiefs, as we call them, or Olatakare in Tumuqua, who helped to kind of bring together this coalition of towns, especially for foreign relations.
I think when we think about northeastern Florida's history, we tend to think about the Tumuqua, but northeast Florida has an incredibly rich indigenous history. I think one that's kind of underappreciated and underpublicized.
Keith Ashley is professor of anthropology at the University of North Florida.
If we think about it, most people, their image of the indigenous people of our area is like a five-year window into the lives of the Tumuqua in the 1560s. When in reality, indigenous people were here 10,000 or more years prior to that time and continued 150 years after that in northeast Florida and still continue to that today. So I think that one thing about this is that we really have this incredible history that we're trying to establish and to really for people to know about. So when we look at the 1560s, we really want to start looking at the history that led to that point in time and not just to focus on that little window. So we've done a lot of archaeology in this area to kind of really reveal that incredible history.
So on a day-to-day basis, most Mocamas lived in a community run largely by women. So households were run by women, who in turn made up the town, who was governed by either a male or female chief or Olata. There are, in fact, many women who ran towns at a political level among the Mocama. And these communities across sort of the region from north of St. Augustine to south of the Altamaha River were really woven together largely by women who created kinship ties across these communities. So they would come together for foreign relations, but on a day-to-day basis, really govern themselves as households and towns.
So really there's no people that are Tumuqua. It's a language that's a Tumuqua language. And then there are a series of dialects throughout the Tumuqua lands that are Mocama is one on Patanos near Gainesville. So really it's just a dialect of a much broader language. And sometimes we'll say Mocama just to provide a little more specificity that we're talking about the ones that are along the coast. Mocama actually means the sea.
They lived especially along the water. They're water people. The word Mocama means the sea, so they're people of the sea, but they were also the people of the marshes. And they had long had contact with outsiders. As far as present-day St. Louis, where Cahokia was in the 11th century, we know there was direct contact with our region too. So long had been part of this very dynamic, diverse, indigenous world that involved religious exchange, political exchange. On the eve of the French arrival, the Mocama are interwoven into sort of a political landscape that includes both alliances within their nation and then also enemies outside of their nation. And it's into this sort of political environment that the French arrive, and this is why the Mocamas have any interest in allying with outsiders, is to help them foster their nation, protect their nation, take care of their homeland.
We know that the Mocama, this is their homeland. We know that it basically stretched from probably just south of the St. John's River, probably to about the Satila River in southeastern Georgia. We know that there was a series of towns that were there. We know the names of some of them, but both the Spanish and the French accounts. Some of them, the Spanish accounts, are a little different than the French accounts. So we understand that there's this network of these towns that are kind of organized. They're in alliances. They're interacting sometimes as friends and sometimes as enemies with other Tumuquas that are further, you know, up or south along the St. John's River. So we can kind of see their kind of relationships playing out in different ways, and the Spanish and French kind of become involved in that situation.
So the French first come in May of 1562, briefly interact over the course of 2 days with Mocama leaders, especially one of the main leaders named Satariwa, who took his name from his town, as was very common with sort of these higher level leaders. He was not only a political leader, but a military leader. The French come briefly. They also explore up to present day South Carolina. They briefly establish a settlement at Paris Island. And then when they come back in 1564, it's expressly to come back here because they have had an okay encounter, complicated, but okay encounter with Satariwa. And they also believe this area is really rich in local resources and will be a great place to establish what is really a military outpost, then hoping to later on establish a colony. So they're coming intentionally to this area, and in large part because of the indigenous people who are already here, who seem to them to be quite wealthy. They notice a lot of gold and silver that Mocamas are wearing. Who also have a lot of food resources, so they hope that they can exploit that too. So that's why they're here, is because of the Mocama.
St. Augustine is the oldest continuously occupied city in what is now the United States. The city was founded in 1565 by the Roman Catholic Spanish. If the Spanish had not sent Don Pedro Menendez de Avilés to Florida to eradicate the Protestant French people at Fort Caroline, St. Augustine may have never been built. Despite this European conflict in Florida, Denise Bosse points out that the region was controlled by the Tumuqua-speaking Mocama.
So Tumuqua is the name of a language, not a people. We know that right before contact, there were probably 10 or 11 dialects of Tumuqua spoken. Mocama was one of those. And the total population of Tumuquas was probably about 200,000 people, stretched really across the center of the current state of Florida, from the east even to the west coast. And they were organized into a lot of different nations. So the Mocama were one nation among many who spoke Tumuqua. And we call the Mocama Mocama. We don't know what they called themselves. So we call them by the name of their dialect to make it a little bit easier. Most Mocamas and most Tumuquas probably mostly identified as members of their families or clans, which were run by women, and then members of towns, who were then grouped into these associations of nations, kind of like our states, you know, the relationship between states and federal government.
Basically, we've established a couple of important things. We know what pottery they were making. We clearly understand as archaeologists that pots are not people, but at least it gives us a good marker. So if we find a lot of pottery that we know dates to this period, we can say that there's a larger settlement here. So I think 20, 25 years ago, we may have said it was another pottery type. Now we're clearly convinced of what it is, so we can establish where we find large amounts of that pottery, that's a community. And so now we're trying to correlate these areas that we find archaeologically with possibly known sites that are in the documents, known towns in the documents. And we feel pretty confident about some of them. We're not forcing our names on those. We've recently been working on Big Talbot Island here in the Jacksonville area, and we're fairly convinced we have the Mocama town of Sarah Bay. And in fact, we've even found a large structure out there that's more than 70 feet in diameter that we think might be their council house. So it's really nice to really, and date, radiocarbon dates. We have some European artifacts that really are going to say that this site is probably 1580s, 1620 range.
We also know about them through Spanish and French records. And it's interesting because until recently, most historians who read records by the French and Spanish largely ignored all of the content about the Mocama. When you read the French themselves, their primary concern is indigenous people. They're very worried about the Spanish because they've invaded what the Spanish claim to be their territory. But once they get on the ground, they quickly realize that all of this space is owned by indigenous people. So they themselves talk a lot about the rituals, the ceremonies, the protocols of diplomacy especially. They talk about religion, they talk about how the Mocamas are organized, what they're eating, and do a lot of what we would think of as sort of early anthropological observations.
Denise Bosse is professor of history and Keith Ashley is professor of anthropology at the University of North Florida. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, download our free magazine, Adventures in Florida Archaeology, watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Floridians are all too familiar with hurricanes and the damage they can cause locally, but they don't always consider how hurricanes and their damage affect national, regional, and even international events. The devastating hurricane that struck St. Augustine in 1811 is a case in point.
Sherry Johnson, who authored a book titled Climate and Catastrophe in Cuba and the Atlantic World in the Age of Revolution, penned an earlier article for the Florida Historical Quarterly in 2005 titled The St. Augustine Hurricane of 1811, in which she examines the hurricane as an example of the role of natural disasters to influence political events. In this case, the geopolitical event was the expected invasion of Spanish East Florida by Georgia farmers under the leadership of General George Matthews. Prior to the hurricane on October 4, 1811, Juan José de Estrada, the interim Spanish governor of East Florida, had begun preparations for the expected invasion and anticipated multiple defections to the American side. Johnson credits Estrada's response to the October storm for the later support of the Spanish defense against the invasion. Disaster studies have identified certain commonalities that were present in the St. Augustine storm. Natural disasters have an immediate leveling effect that leads to an us-against-them mentality of solidarity. Furthermore, Johnson notes a strong causal relationship exists among the demands of the population, inadequate government response to the crisis, and political unrest. On one hand, if the community's needs were met, the reaction would be cooperation, gratitude, and strong feelings of loyalty to the existing regime. On the other hand, indifference and incompetence foster resentment, resistance, and/or revolt.
Connie, the early 19th century was a period of turmoil for the Spanish government and its empire. The response to the remote Florida outposts could be expected to be inadequate and result in outright rebellion or at least unwillingness to resist the American incursion.
Turmoil and chaos characterized the Spanish Empire, beginning with the loss of Florida to the British following the Seven Years' War in Europe or the French and Indian War in the British colonies. From 1763 to 1783, following the British victory, East Florida was under British control before its return to Spain at the end of the American Revolution. During the later European Peninsular War from 1807 to 1814, Napoleon Bonaparte deposed the Spanish king and installed his brother Joseph as monarch. In the resulting resistance, communications broke down between Spain and its colonies, and Florida, like other parts of Hispanic Caribbean, went through long periods without receiving payment of the sitiuato, leaving colonial areas in economic crisis and vulnerable to the promises of outside and invading forces. The aftermath of an intense and destructive hurricane, such as the one that hit St. Augustine in 1811, had the potential to further alienate local residents. However, Johnson argues that ties to Spanish rule were strengthened as policies for dealing with disasters that had been developed decades earlier operated to provide relief and assist in rebuilding. On the morning following landfall of the storm, Estrada was out in the community organizing neighborhood commissioners to gather information about individual losses. As their records demonstrated, the storm surge flooded the city, destroying homes, crops, businesses, boats, and tools for rebuilding and sustaining the community. Only 3 people lost their lives, but St. Augustine remained in peril as foodstuffs, ovens for baking bread, and carpenter and blacksmithing tools were lost to the floodwaters. The monetary loss was calculated at 65,000 pesos, ranging from individual losses of thousands of pesos to a modest claim of 8 pesos for the loss of used clothing. The immediate problem centered on providing residents with food, clothing, and shelter. Estrada called out all civilian and military men to assist survivors and aid in clearing the debris. He sent messages inland to assess the damage in surrounding towns and calculate their ability to provide supplies. Inland farmers provided shipments of food within days. They also provided palmetto thatch to repair roofs and provide protection from the elements. With no expectation of relief from Spain, Estrada called on the merchants of Fernandina to donate supplies for recovery. As Johnson notes, quote, although some degree of coercion was almost always imputed in government requests for voluntary donations, also implicit in the request was that those who stepped forward to help in times of trouble would expect some reward in the future. To no one's surprise, barely 3 weeks after the arrival of emergency supplies, Fernandina petitioned Estrada and Treasury official Manuel Lopez for a reduction in the amount paid to conduct business, end quote. In December, Estrada forwarded a package of letters and reports to Cuba to be sent on to Spain, outlining the destruction and the petitions for reimbursement or tax relief. Estrada carefully justified his actions, including his demands for relief from Fernandino's merchants. He closed his report with a comment on the character of East Florida residents. Quote, they are entirely ruined, but they have managed to survive with a great deal of patience, end quote. Johnson concludes, quote, one of the greatest enigmas of the Second Spanish period is the unwavering loyalty of the majority of the population. What could have been, indeed should have been, a total breakdown of civil and military society in Spanish Florida after the hurricane of 1811 did not happen. Conditions were ripe for rebellion if rebellion and independence from Spain really were desired by the residents. General Matthews' invasion force awaited across the St. Mary's River, and they could compare the general's promises with the recent actions of their Spanish governor. Even before the storm struck, Estrada had offered conciliatory measures to both Anglo settlers and Seminole tribes. In the aftermath of the hurricane, it was clear that emergency measures included everyone. No one was excluded from the responsibilities to help or from the sharing in the generosity of their neighbors. Neither rich nor poor, nor invalids, nor free people of color, women or children. Estrada's response continued the policies of previous decades, and in so doing, the positive governmental response sustained Spanish Floridians' feelings of community and loyalty to the empire, end quote. As Johnson demonstrates, as with other hurricanes across the centuries, the 1811 hurricane devastated a community but shaped national and international history.
Well, let's hope we avoid any history-making hurricanes or violent revolutions in the near future. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. In the 1960s, University of Florida professor Marshall Jones was accused of being a communist for his civil rights activism and union organizing activities. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Katie Rainwater serves as a faculty member in the sociology program at Florida International University. She recently delivered a presentation at the 91st annual meeting of the Southern Historical Association in St. Pete Beach, Florida, titled Old South or Berkeley of the South, Marshall Jones, The Struggle for Racial Integration, and the Origins of Faculty Unionism at the University of Florida. In 1962, the University of Florida hired Marshall Jones, a white professor of psychology who had a background of participating in civil rights protests in Pensacola. Despite receiving a job from a university that implicitly endorsed notions of the Old South and explicitly embraced a slow process of integration, Jones continued his racial activism in Gainesville.
The first activism in which he was involved in Gainesville was around the Florida Theater. And in that case, the NAACP Youth Council organized these pickets of the Florida Theater, which was still a segregated establishment. And Jones and some other kind of students went to support them. One of the students, Jesse Dean, Jones knew from Pensacola. Jesse Dean wanted to kind of push them in a more radical direction because he was used to the pretty militant movement from Pensacola. And Jones thought it was kind of a bad idea for a student to go in and tell the local youth what they should be doing. And so they decided to form their own group. And that was a student group for equal rights. And that was a group that was fighting to integrate the town and integrate commercial establishments around the town. At that point, they weren't very directed toward campus-based activities, but some of the students began to be disciplined by the administration for their involvement in the movement. And so then that kind of pulled Jones and the students a bit more into contesting power relations on campus. The scope of activities that they engaged in were really expanded, right? They were fighting for free speech rights on campus. They were opposing the Vietnam War. They were opposing the firing of this activist faculty member that had gotten fired, right? They were involved in censorship issues with the student paper. And then also fighting more for integration on campus. So it turned from a movement that was basically engaged in off-campus issues to more engagement in on-campus issues.
Despite Jones's initial hesitation to adopt more aggressive measures to advocate for students' civil rights on campus, he eventually embraced such an approach, culminating in a speech he delivered in 1965 titled, The Role of the Teacher in Social Change.
Jones came around to this student's theory of change, which is basically you're not going to make change by persuading people in power to go against their interests, right? You can only answer power with power, and that sometimes involves disruptive tactics. And so he totally embraced that theory of change. And in fact, students were eager to seek mentorship and engage with faculty members that were addressing the issues of the day. And I think the students in the movement were generally interested in him and what he had to say about strategy, right? And so that's in part why he was, you know, invited to give the talk. And so this was the piece that the administration cited for saying Jones didn't deserve to have a place at the university, right? Because when he argued in this place that students needed to make change through rebellion instead of going through the conventional channels. They argued that Jones was arguing for a principle which contradicts the principles upon which true universities could be based.
As a result, the University of Florida denied Jones's tenure and informed him of his termination by the end of the 1967-68 academic year. Jones appealed the university's decision through the Faculty Senate Committee, citing an infringement of his academic freedom.
His comrades in the movement, so his student comrades, his faculty comrades, they had his back and they were ready to fight. Others, an anonymous faculty member wrote to the paper and was like, I'm so tired of Marshall Jones and so glad the administration took this move. The sort of majority position among the faculty was that, okay, maybe this is a denial of academic freedom. Maybe the administration has a case and was acting within their right. We like need to wait for this to kind of be decided. And so a committee in the faculty senate was convened to decide the case. But at the same time, Jones and his supporters were engaging in channels outside of the Senate, right? So they had a students organized a protest for Jones that brought about 500 people out. There was one at FSU. 100-something faculty took out a paid ad in support of his tenure, and then like letters to the paper, etc. So he had people organizing in his defense, but unfortunately, that movement wasn't kind of strong enough to change the administration's mind and to enable him to keep his job.
On the same day the committee upheld his tenure denial and termination from UF, Jones received approval from the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, for an application he co-submitted with 61 other faculty members to form a faculty union in Florida. This union, known as the United Faculty of Florida, remains in existence today, underscoring the legacy Jones left during his tumultuous time at UF.
The same day that the story ran in the student paper that committee of the Faculty Senate had decided the administration had not violated his academic freedom, right? And thus he would be terminated. Another article ran on that same newspaper page saying that the union that they had applied for a charter with the AFT on May Day 1968, that charter had been granted and now they were officially a chapter of the AFT. So they were local 1880 of the AFT. And another kind of line we can trace is that Ken McGill, he was a faculty member. He went to that rally in support of tenure of Jones. He stood up in front of 500 people and said, I not only am here fighting for Jones's right for speech, but I'm here to say I support what he said and I agree. He became one of the earliest leaders of the union that Jones founded, and he would actually go on to be fired as well. But the union that Jones founded, you know, it lasts until today, the United Faculty of Florida.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can always find us online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.